This Is Your Life, episode 44.
This is your life. Are you who you wanna be? This is your life. Are you who you wanna be? This is your life. Is everything you dreamed it would be when the world was younger and you had everything?
Hello and welcome to this episode of This Is Your Life. My name is Michael Hyatt, and this is the podcast dedicated to intentional leadership. My goal is to help you live with more passion, work with greater focus, and lead with extraordinary influence. In this episode, I'll be talking about how to overcome the resistance. If you're not familiar with the resistance, this is the term that Stephen Pressfield coined to describe that invisible, destructive force that opposes you anytime you try to start a new project or make an improvement in any area of your life. You know what I'm talking about. But first, this podcast is brought to you by Platform University, an online membership site for helping you launch your personal platform or take it to the next level. You can find out more at platformuniversity.com. I'll be telling you a little bit more about it at the end of this podcast, so stay tuned. But let's get right into this episode. I want to share with you my story about getting my first book published because I think it illustrates what we're talking about when we talk about the resistance. Here's how it goes. In 1997, a friend of mine urged me to consider writing a book that would eventually become The Millennium Bug, which was a New York Times bestseller, but at that time it was just an idea. He was a very well-connected literary agent, and he was confident he could find several publishers interested in buying it. So I did what I had advised authors to do my entire career, which was to prepare a formal book proposal. My agent friend then began the process of trying to sell it, and he pitched the book to 30 different publishers. Now get this, the first 29 rejected it. I was discouraged, and I wanted to throw in the towel, but my agent wouldn't let me. He persisted. Finally, Regnery Publishing, the 30th publisher, agreed to publish the book and offered me a contract. And I was thrilled right up until I realized now I had to write the book. And that's when the real work began, or so I thought. I was determined to meet my deadline. I'd been a publisher for decades. I'd worked as a literary agent. I knew how important meeting your deadline is as an author. So I mapped out a writing plan. I calculated how many words I had to write a day to meet the deadline. And then I worked from 4 a.m. to 7:30 a.m. daily. And then I went to my day job because, like most writers starting out, I didn't have the luxury of being able to escape for several weeks and just write the book. But unfortunately, as I approached the finish line, I started falling behind in my daily word count. And it was becoming clear that I was going to miss my deadline. And that simply was unacceptable to me. So I checked myself into an extended stay hotel for 2 weeks to finish the book. And I wrote every day for 10 to 12 hours a day. I then hired a professional copy editor to edit the manuscript. And miraculously, I was able to turn in my manuscript by the due date. It almost killed me, but I did it. And I was very proud, to be honest, of the finished work. And I kind of envisioned my editor saying, "Wow, this is an amazing manuscript. It's so clean. We've never seen anything like it." I mean, that was kind of the fantasy that was playing in my brain. Well, I didn't hear a word from the publisher for almost 3 months. Then suddenly, without so much as a phone call, I received the edited manuscript back in the mail via FedEx. My editor had marked up almost every page with red lines and notes, and some pages were completely crossed out, and my heart sank as I looked at it. I don't know if it harkened back to my days in high school or grammar school where that happened when you got a paper turned back to you, but at any rate, my heart sank. Well, I hadn't factored into my schedule the time for the editing and the rewrite process, and as I would later learn, this was a common rookie mistake, but I spent the next 30 days, early mornings, evenings, and weekends, revising, editing, and polishing my manuscript. But I finally finished it, and I resubmitted it to the publisher. And I didn't hear a peep until 6 weeks before the official pub date. That's when the publisher called and explained that his sales staff had been unsuccessful in trying to place the book. Again, my heart sank. He said, "The bookstore buyers just don't get it," he explained. "They don't know if it's a computer book or a current events book, and I'm afraid we're going to have to cancel publication." Well, drawing on my previous sales experience, I talked him into continuing with the book's publication. However, he said it would be a small print run of no more than 2,500 copies. And I was, of course, disappointed. But honestly, I didn't really have any other alternative because I'd announced it now to all my friends that the book was going to be published. I was all excited. My family had made a sacrifice for me to write it. And it, you know, it just had to happen. So we took what we had. Well, Regnery then assigned me to a publicist to help promote the book. However, I couldn't get her to return my calls or my voicemails. And the publishing date was fast approaching. I was getting desperate. Finally, another publicist called me. And after a brief introduction, she said, look, your original publicist is not going to work on this book. And the publisher just doesn't think it has enough potential. So they assigned me to it. And frankly, I don't get the book at all. And I thought to myself, great, maybe this book is just not meant to be. And I kind of started resigning myself to my fate. But again, I summoned my best sales skills. I explained who the audience was for the book and why I thought it would work. And she reluctantly agreed to write a pitch letter and then fax it to the top media outlets. This was way back in the day before some of you may have been born, back when we used fax machines. But she sent out a fax blast, got the word out, and lo and behold, radio stations, television stations, to our surprise, started calling to book me as a guest. And in the first 30 days after publication, I appeared on more than 100 shows, and the book began to take off. It was really cool. And within the first week, the publisher had to go back to press. Well, 6 weeks after publication, the book hit the New York Times bestsellers list, where it remained for 28 weeks. And during this time, I did more than 1,000 interviews. Some days, I would do 12 to 14 interviews in a row, and it was demanding and draining work. And on top of that, I still had my day job. Fortunately, I had worked out before I took this job with my employer that I had this book deal, and I had committed to doing the publicity. And he said, hey, no problem, probably thinking it'd be a few interviews. But he kept his word. I was able to do that many interviews, but it was unbelievable. It was like having two full-time jobs, and that went that way for literally 18 months. Well, the book eventually sold about 360,000 copies. It was an incredible outcome for a book that almost didn't get published. And if I had known how much work the publishing process would require, both in writing the manuscript and then in promoting the book, I'm sure I wouldn't have signed up. Well, why do I tell you this story? Because I want to talk about the resistance. Stephen Pressfield first coined the term, I think, in The War of Art, but it's a powerful must-read book for anyone who's trying to accomplish anything significant in life, whether it's losing weight, stopping smoking, writing a book, launching a new business, or building a healthy, happy marriage. And again, the book's called The War of Art. I've got a link in the show notes to it so you can go right to it. But he says that the resistance is that invisible, destructive force that opposes you anytime you try to accomplish something significant or make an improvement in any area of your life. For example, resistance is that thing that makes you want to organize your closet when you sit down to write. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Resistance is that thing that makes you want to sleep in instead of going to the gym. Resistance is that thing that makes you focus on one critical comment instead of the 99 that were positive about your blog post. Resistance is that thing that makes you want to stay home where it's safe rather than go to that meeting where there are people you don't know. Resistance is that thing that makes you tweak your blog style sheet rather than crank out another blog post. It's also that thing that made me want to quit in the publication of my first book when 29 publishers rejected me, when I didn't think I could meet my deadline, when I got the first round of edits back from my editor, when the publisher said he was going to cancel the publication of the book, when the publicist wouldn't return my phone calls, and when the second publicist told me she didn't get it. As I mentioned, Pressfield coined the term in The War of Art, but he developed the concept even more in a little book called Do the Work, which is also a must-read book. In fact, I just listened to the unabridged audiobook this past weekend in preparation for the new book I'm beginning to write this week, and I enjoyed it even more than reading the book. Pressfield read it himself in his own voice, which was really fun just to hear his inflection and his emotion around the content. In this episode, I want to build on Pressfield's work and provide you with some practical countermeasures for dealing with the resistance. I spoke on this topic at the recent Platform Conference, and it was so well received that I thought I'd share it with you in this podcast. But before we get into how to defeat it, I want us to make sure that we understand it, what it is, and its attributes. Pressfield says, quote, resistance cannot be seen, touched, heard, or smelled. but it can be felt. We experience it as an energy field radiating from a work in potential. It's a repelling force. It's negative. Its aim is to shove us away, distract us, prevent us from doing our work, end quote. And that's from The War of Art. Resistance has four attributes I want to cover, and Pressfield has more than this, but these are, it seems to me, the primary ones, and all of them conveniently start with the letter I. Attribute number one, it's invisible. For example, think of pilots approaching the sound barrier, which is 768 miles an hour at sea level. They couldn't see it. They could only feel it as their aircraft approached this speed, and their planes would shake violently. In fact, many aeronautical engineers thought this was a real barrier that could not be breached. Then, of course, Chuck Yeager officially broke the sound barrier on October the 14th, 1947, and we've been breaking it ever since. As it turns out, it was only invisible. Attribute number two, it's internal. For example, years ago, I heard a speaker talk about a research project conducted by a marine biologist. It seems he put a barracuda in a large tank. He then released smaller bait fish into the same tank, and as expected, the barracuda attacked and ate the smaller fish, made really short work of them. But then the researcher inserted a piece of glass into the tank, creating two separate chambers. He put the barracuda into one and new bait fish into the second, and the barracuda immediately attacked. This time, however, he hit the glass and he bounced off. Undaunted, the barracuda kept repeating this behavior every few minutes, and meanwhile, the bait fish swam unharmed in the second chamber. But eventually, the barracuda gave up. The biologist repeated this experiment several times over the next few days. Each time, the barracuda got less aggressive until eventually he got tired of hitting the glass and stopped striking it altogether. Then the researcher removed the glass. The barracuda, now trained to believe a barrier existed between him and the bait fish, didn't attack. In fact, the bait fish swam unassailed wherever they wished. And too often, I feel like we're like those barracuda. The resistance isn't out there per se. It only exists inside our heads. In other words, it's internal. Think how many other barriers have turned out to be only internal mental obstacles. For example, the 4-minute mile. Runners didn't think it was possible to run a mile in less than 4 minutes. Then in 1954, Roger Bannister ran it in 3 minutes and 59 seconds. Then the 2-hour marathon. Endurance athletes didn't think it was possible to run a marathon in less than 2 hours, and now several athletes are on the very verge of breaking Jeffrey Mutai's world record of 2 hours and 3 minutes. To quote Pressfield again, resistance is not a peripheral opponent. Resistance arises from within. It is self-generated and self-perpetuated. Resistance is the enemy within. You know, often it's the direct result of a story we're telling ourselves. For example, I had a friend, Bill, who was saying to himself, no one wants to hire someone my age when they can get someone younger for half the price. That story became the resistance. Or another friend of mine, Jennifer, who said, I'm just not good at public speaking. Or another friend of mine, Gary, who said to himself, I can't write. I have ADHD. Again, this is a form of the resistance. It's an internal barrier. Attribute number three, it is insidious. In other words, it opposes every good thing, and its intent is on keeping you from becoming all that God created you to be. I think this is really it. It resists potential. It doesn't want us to go there, and it tries to fight us. Again, Pressfield says, this is from The War of Art, quote, resistance will tell you anything to keep you from doing your work. It will perjure, fabricate, falsify, seduce, bully, and cajole, end quote. Attribute number four, it's infallible. And frankly, this is where there's some hope as well, because it's like a magnetized needle floating on the surface of oil. Resistance will unfailingly point to true north, meaning that calling or action it most wants us to stop from doing. And if you're experiencing resistance, it's likely an indication that you're headed in the right direction. Pressfield says, we can use this. We can use it as a compass. We can navigate by resistance, letting it guide us to that calling or action that we must follow before all others. Again, from The War of Art. Let me give you a few of examples of how this works. You will not experience resistance if you order dessert, but you might experience it if you're determined to lose 20 pounds. You'll not experience resistance if you decide to sleep in, but you might experience it if you're determined to exercise 4 times a week. You'll not experience resistance if you stop writing and go check Facebook again. But you might experience it if you've made a commitment to blog 3 times a week. The more important the work is, the more opposition you'll experience, and we can use this to guide us. So that's what resistance is. Now, what do we do about it? That's really the question for this episode. And here's my premise. You can defeat the resistance by understanding its 3 primary strategies and applying appropriate countermeasures. Now, Pressfield talks a lot about this. He doesn't organize it in quite this way. I wanted to simplify it, so I put it into these 3 strategies and the 3 countermeasures. So here we go. Strategy number 1 that the resistance uses is fear. Resistance often uses this at the very beginning of a project. If you're afraid, by the way, you're normal. I think most of us are afraid when we take on something that is bigger than we've ever done before or something that we simply haven't done before. And the typical response to that is procrastination. The countermeasure is to start. Recently, Gail and I went on a vacation in Fiji, and we went with a bunch of people. It was part of a program. And the very first day, they wanted us to teach us a lesson in overcoming fear. So we had to climb up on these 50-foot poles and stand on the top of them. Now, we were strapped in, we were harnessed in, so there really wasn't anything to fear. But as it turns out, one of the major things, one of the almost primal that humans have is the fear of heights. And believe me, as I started to think about it and I started to visualize the possibility of falling, which I don't advise, not a very good strategy on my part, but I got fearful. And one of the things that stopped that fear was just starting. And I said to myself, all I got to do is mount the pole. And then I would say to myself, all I've got to do is take another step. And when I got to the top, all I've got to do is stand on top of this. And I did stand on top of it. It was an awesome experience, but it was fear. And the only way to counter that was to start. Same thing when you're writing a new book. And I've written about 7 now, and I'm about to start my 8th one. And I can tell you that starting is the most important part. And I've made this easy on myself, by the way. I don't sit down and try to, you know, tackle the chapter I think is going to be the toughest first. That's a recipe for a disaster. I start with the easy stuff first because I want to build momentum. So I'll start with the front matter, you know, the title page, the half title page, the copyright page, the dedication, the table of contents. I want to get a sense of momentum and a sense of progress. So that's where I start. A few years ago, I discovered a wonderful quote by W.H. Murray, a Scottish mountain climber and writer. In fact, Stephen Pressfield quotes this in Do the Work, but I had stumbled upon it before I read it there. But here's what W.H. Murray says. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy. The chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creativity, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents. Meetings and material assistance, which no man could have dreamt would have come his way, I have learned a deep respect for one of Goethe's couplets. Whatever you can do or dream, you can begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. End quote. And again, that's W.H. Murray. Here's the deal. Whatever it is you think you need in order to begin won't show up until you take the first step. That is so important. Let me just say it again. Whatever it is that you think you need in order to begin usually won't show up until you take that first step. The countermeasure to fear is to start. We have to develop the discipline of beginning. What is it that you need to start? You need to look fear in the face and just step into it. It's that simple. That leads us to strategy number 2, which is uncertainty. Resistance often uses this in the middle of a project. Don Miller talks about this in his excellent book, 1,000,000 Miles in 1,000 Years. But it's that most dangerous part of any project. And Don uses this illustration. It's like you're going to swim from here to this island that's out maybe in the middle of a lake. And you get out there, it doesn't seem so far when you're standing on the shore, but as you get into it, you realize about halfway there that it's further than you thought. But now you're at a point where you're too far out to go back, but you don't know if you have enough strength to continue. And so you have this tremendous sense of uncertainty. But this manifests itself as anxiety, self-doubt, feeling overwhelmed. And if you feel that way in the middle of some big project, whatever it is that you're in the middle of right now, congratulations, you're normal. That's how it always feels in the middle. I've had this experience hundreds of times in the middle of major projects where I just feel very uncertain. I'm not sure what to do. But know this, you always feel uncertain right before you feel certain. You always don't know the right answer before you do. And the typical response to this is rather than kind of, you know, get focused and stick with it, we get distracted. That's the typical response. You know, we just decide we're going to, you know, organize the closet, or we're going to go out and check Facebook one more time. But the typical response is distraction. The countermeasure is to focus. And maybe it requires using a timer. Maybe it requires using music. Maybe it requires giving yourself a reward, but you've got to stay focused and you have to develop the discipline of pushing through. This is the only way to get out of the middle of the project, is to just push through, which leads us to the third strategy and countermeasure. The third strategy is doubt. Resistance often uses this at the end of a project. I remember years ago reading a story about Pat Williams, who was the general manager for the Orlando Magic, and he was running the Boston Marathon with one of his daughters. And towards the end of it, when they got to Heartbreak Hill, which is a very steep incline towards the end of the race, she said to him, kind of half joking, she said, "Dad, why are we running this marathon? What were we thinking?" And he said to her very soberly, and I think very insightfully, he said, "We're doing this to practice not quitting." Oh, it's so important to learn not to quit, to be able to push through. After I submitted my book Platform to Thomas Nelson, to my editor, I called my editor and I thought maybe we should consider delaying the project, because I was going through this tremendous sense of self-doubt. Like, you know, it's not good enough. If I just had another few weeks, you know, we could make it even better. So, you know, it was just a real temptation not to finish. Another example of that was when we launched Platform University. I remember thinking the day we launched it, we just need another 2 weeks. You know, I just doubted that what we had was valuable enough to offer it up to the world. And I thought of 1,000 things I wanted to change or to modify or to improve. But fortunately, I had great teammates who wouldn't let me, and their attitude was just ship it. So the typical response when you experience doubt is to quit. And the countermeasure to this is to finish at all costs. You've got to develop the discipline of finishing. This is something I've been learning, something I'm trying to practice in every project that I'm working on, is just to push through and finish and not give in to that third strategy of resistance, which is doubt. So just in conclusion, you can defeat the resistance by understanding its three primary strategies and applying the appropriate countermeasures. The three strategies, again, are fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And the three countermeasures to that are to start, to focus, and to finish. And that's all there in the show notes. If you want to go to my blog at michaelhyatt.com/044, as in episode 44. One final story. When I became the president of Thomas Nelson, I experienced unprecedented resistance. It was the best of times and the worst of times. Within a couple of months of assuming that post, I broke my ankle. Then I went through a massive IRS audit. Gail's dad died. We experienced major teenage rebellion issues with two of our daughters. And numerous times in the middle of that, I wanted to quit. You know, it was something I felt was really important. And I'm not suggesting that you know, God or somebody did all these things, but these things came into my life and the resistance on the inside made me want to quit, made me want to give in. But I realized that defeating the resistance was essential to me going to the next level. And more important, it was essential in my transformation. And you know what? It's essential to your transformation too. Who you are becoming is even more important than what you are doing. Let me repeat that again. Who you are becoming is even more important than what you're doing. And like a butterfly, the resistance is intended to make your wings strong so you can fly. So with that, let's get to some listener questions. The first one comes from Jeff.
Hey, Michael, this is Jeff Sanders from jeffsanders.tv. On a typical day, I have a lot of energy and a bunch of ideas, but my own creativity seems to distract me from focusing on my highest priorities. Do you have any strategies to calm your mind and focus to ensure that you are not your own greatest resistance? Thanks for the help, Michael.
Jeff, I totally get this question. I struggle with this myself every single day. So again, congratulations, you're normal. First thing I do is calm my mind for 15 minutes. And I describe this process in episode 28, Becoming More Productive by Reengineering Your Morning Ritual. So you might want to listen to that if you haven't. But I just try to have 15 minutes where I'm not doing anything. I'm not praying. I'm not reading. I'm not saying affirmations. I'm just trying to be quiet and let my mind settle, kind of like a jar of muddy water. I want the sediment to settle out so I can get clarity about what I need to be doing that day. Second thing I do is go ahead and capture the idea. I use Evernote. If I've got a creative idea, I'm not going to stop and work on it then, but I am going to capture it so it doesn't continue to be a distraction. And one of the things that we've learned to do as a team, because I have these ideas about every day, especially once I get off the treadmill or I've been on a run and now the blood's coursing through my brain. I'm getting all kinds of ideas. You know, the endorphins are doing their magic. And I come up with ideas. And my team just says, great, let's add that to the project list. And then we can forget it and get back to the work at hand. So I would use some kind of reliable capture system like Evernote, where you can capture this stuff and come back to it later. And it's kind of an interesting process. In fact, I think I described this last week, but a lot of times we'll put those on the list and come back a month later, and then they're not so urgent. You know, maybe because we've let them percolate a little bit, they've lost a little bit of the brilliance and the shininess that they had initially. And so we can put them in a better perspective. The ideas that endure that process, that are still shiny and exciting a month after we put them into the pot, are real candidates for pursuing because they've got that staying power. The next question comes from Jen.
Hey, Michael, this is Jen McDonough from TheIronJen.com. My question on overcoming resistance is when you're in the throes of that resistance, say it's at work or through the daily grind of building that platform, what outside things do you bring into your life that help you persevere to get through those times where you're really struggling? I look forward to this episode. Wanted to say thanks for letting us be a part of Platform University. Awfully excited about the things that you're doing and the things that you're offering for us out there. Looking forward to your answer.
Thanks, Jen. I really appreciate your enthusiasm. Very encouraging to me personally. Pressfield calls these allies in Do the Work. These are those people who, or those things that conspire to help us actually when we start moving in the right direction. But here's how I deal with it. I listen to podcasts and read books that are inspiring. I try to saturate my mind, bringing these things in, these outside influences in, so that they keep me going as I fight the resistance. I also surround myself with strong, supportive friends. I try to be very strategic with my friendships. I'm not trying to use people. There's people I want to serve too, but I don't want to surround myself with people that are negative or people that end up becoming the resistance in my life. I want people that are going to encourage me, sometimes confront me, sometimes challenge me, sometimes slap me around and tell me that I need to get back on it and get focused. But those are some of the outside influences or allies that I am very careful to recruit and use in my life so that I can keep going when I want to quit. The next question comes from Joanna.
Hi, my name is Joanna Holman, and I'm calling from Melbourne, Australia. You can find me online at joannamuses.com. My question is, how do you know that what you're facing is resistance rather than a sign that what you're doing is not the right thing for you or that you're doing too much and need to back off a bit? Thanks.
Joanna, this is a great question. It's one that all of us face. Again, it's normal. Uncertainty, though, is that strategy the resistance often employs in the middle of a project, and we've got to remember that. I would encourage you to read Seth Godin's very short book, The Dip, subtitled A Little Book That Teaches You When to Quit and When to Stick. And he offers some distinctions in there that I think you'll find very helpful. But for me, one of the things that I do is I try to back away from the project and get some time to reflect. I want to find or rediscover my why. In other words, why am I doing this project? What's at stake? Is my heart still in it? And that's where I came to, for example, when I was writing the platform book. Everything within me wanted to quit. I felt like when I had the manuscript and I had it done, I just didn't feel like it was my best work. I thought there was so much that could be done. But I really got apart by myself and just did a gut check and said, is this important? What's at stake? And I came to the conclusion that yes, absolutely it was. This was nothing but the usual ugly resistance that always shows up at this point in the project. You could almost set your watch to it. This was so predictable. And, you know, after I've done several projects like this, in fact, Pressfield talks about this in Do the Work, once you've defeated the resistance once, you'll never not finish, at least because of the resistance. You may decide to lay something down because it's not the right project and pursue something else, but it won't be because you've been defeated by the resistance, because you know that you have the power, you have the ability to defeat it, and it's just predictable. It's kind of the usual thing that we all go through. So I would suggest you do that. Read Seth's book and also step away, take some time to reflect and get reconnected with your why. The next question comes from Mark.
Hi, Michael. My name is Mark, and I write about intentional spiritual living at markalanchelsky.com. I've already learned that my biggest area of resistance comes from perfectionism. There's always some way that what I'm writing or creating can be better, and then I get trapped in this cycle of reiterating and reiterating and never shipping. What have you found most helpful in stopping the cycle of perfectionism and just getting your product out the door? Thanks for your answer, and thank you for everything you're doing to help us be better too.
Mark, I use two things that keep me from getting into that cycle. And believe me, if left to myself, I would be right there in that cycle with every project, never quite getting it done, always polishing and never getting out the door, never shipping. But two things I do is, number one, I set a deadline. And for some reason, deadlines with me are very motivational. I want to keep the deadline. I want to meet the deadline. And that just motivates me to try to cross the finish line and finally ship it. The other thing is using a team. I need the help of my teammates. I need the people that will say to me, let's ship it. It's good enough. And, you know, this has to be balanced with wow. I get that. Wrote a book about that. But at the end of the day, you've got to ship it. So deadlines and a team, they give me the accountability and I think can really help all of us as we move forward in our effort to ship whatever it is we're creating. Next question comes from Sue.
Hi, this is Sue Dantweiler from Nashville, Tennessee, with SueDantweiler.com. Michael, I have really enjoyed reading the book, Do the Work. Thanks for the gift at the recent Platform Conference. Stephen Pressfield's subheading of that book is Overcome Resistance and Get Out of Your Own Way. My question is, what are ways that we personally create resistance and sabotage our own progress?
Sue, I really think this is highly personal, and it's definitely worth exploring how you, in particular, sabotage your own progress. That's what I've had to do, because the ways I do it are probably different than the ways you do it. A few of mine, though, is overcommitting. You know, it's just like it's easier to keep committing to projects and keep starting things rather than actually finishing. One of the things I do, too, is perfectionism, just continuing to polish it and getting it almost there but not shipping it. Distraction is huge for me. I face huge distractions. You know, it's much easier to, as I said earlier, organize my closet or organize my desk or organize Evernote, or, you know, there's 1,001 things for me that are really sabotage kinds of behaviors that aren't productive given what I'm committed to do. So I think also we should pay attention to our special attention to our words, because they reveal what we're thinking. You know, it's like the Bible says, as a man thinks, so is he. And I try to be really focused in my thinking, because oftentimes that's what undoes me. So for example, instead of saying to myself, man, I feel distracted today, which frankly only reinforces the distraction, I say to myself intentionally, I feel creative, focused, and productive. And yes, I have a series of affirmations that I go over that are intended to focus my mind on what I want, not on what I don't want. I don't think there's any magical power to this, but I do think that our language shapes reality, or at least how we perceive it. Change your language, change your life. So that's one of the ways that I'm currently employing, and it's working great to overcome these self-sabotaging behaviors, because it all originates in our brains. And that's really where the problem is our thinking that produces these outward results. Thanks for your question. The next one comes from Travis.
Hi, Michael. This is Travis Dahmer calling from I Run, You Run in Atlanta. Listeners can find our Greatness blog and Greatness app at irunyourun.com. I'm curious how resistance works in the presence of groups. We've been learning that 10 to 12 person groups are optimal for helping people change behavior and drive performance at work. But does Stephen talk about whether accountability partners are an effective weapon against resistance, or can resistance even take over a group and somehow cause it to hold you back? I'd be curious to get your take as well. Thanks so much, Michael. Bye-bye.
Travis, honestly, I don't remember Pressfield talking about accountability partners. I've reread both The War of Art and Do the Work in the last month, and I just may be wrong, but I don't remember him talking about that specific thing. So I'm just going to give you my opinion. I think resistance can definitely show up in a group, which is why it's so very important to pick your friends well, to pick the company you work for well, to build the culture that you're living and moving in. Pick that well. You've got to be very strategic. And you may think, but I don't have any friends that will really support me. And I don't know anyone. Everybody seems to be part of the resistance. You know, they're not really for me. They don't think I can do this. They're making me second guess myself. Well, again, one way around this, I think, is by reading books and listening to podcasts. The main thing is to saturate your mind with empowering thoughts. You know, there's a real sense in which I can say, like I did this morning, I went on a run with Ray Edwards. Because why? I listened to Ray Edwards' podcast. You know, he's one of my mentors. Or I can surround myself with other people like John Maxwell and Dave Ramsey and Seth Godin and Stephen Pressfield. And all these people can become part of my mastermind in a sense. They're not even aware of it. They're not even consciously participating. But because of their work, I can steep myself into it and it can be very helpful in creating the kind of environment that will lead to my success. Great question. Well, let me leave you with one question today, and you can respond to this on my blog, again, at michaelhyatt.com/044, as in episode 44. And the question is this: how has the resistance shown up in your life, and what have you learned about it? I would just love any tips. I'm genuinely and honestly on a quest to learn all I can about this myself so that I can more readily defeat it and be more successful in the creative endeavors that I undertake. Just two quick announcements. I want to remind you about my 21-session audio course entitled Get Published. If you've ever thought about writing a book but didn't know where to start, this course is for you. Or if you already have a book but want to do everything you can to make the biggest splash you can in the marketplace, this course is for you. 21 audio sessions, literally everything I've learned about publishing in my 30 years in the industry as a publisher, most recently as the CEO of Thomas Nelson Publishers, a literary agent, and a two-time New York Times bestselling author. And you can find out more information at michaelhyatt.com/get published. Second announcement is Platform University continues to do well. Yesterday, we posted a killer masterclass with Jeff Goins. It's all about going pro. Jeff has just recently done this with his own platform. He's now supporting himself full-time, and he explains how he did it in just 2 years. That's not to say the segment's 2 years long, but in 2 years, he went full-time and turned pro. You can find out more at platformuniversity.com. This is a membership site, if you haven't heard of it. It's a membership site specifically designed for those wanting to build a platform or take their existing platform to the next level. Every month, we post 4 new sessions. Week 1, we post the masterclass interview, where I interview the world's leading experts on some aspect of platform building. Week 2, we do a member makeover where I evaluate one of our member platforms and provide the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I do this as a screencast so you can look over my shoulder and see what I see to improve that particular platform. Week number 3 is Backstage Pass, where I take you behind the curtain and reveal some aspect of my business and how I do what I do. And then week number 4 is the Q&A call, where you have a chance to get your specific questions answered in a live conference call. In addition to that, we have an incredibly active discussion forum where people ask and get answered all kinds of platform related questions. Again, you can check us out at platformuniversity.com. Finally, my next podcast will be on the topic of Inside My Toolbox, and I'm going to share with you some of the tools I use on a day-to-day basis. I'll talk about blogging tools, presentation tools, my task management tools, my book writing tools, and a whole lot more. But if you've got a question about this topic, please leave me a voicemail message at michaelhyatt.com/podcast question. This is a terrific way to cross-promote your blog or website because I'll link to it just as I did with the callers in this episode. Well, that's it for this episode of This Is Your Life. I'd be grateful if you would rate my podcast on iTunes. That helps tremendously with keeping my podcast visible so people who have never heard of it can discover it. And if you'd like to comment on this episode, please go to michaelhyatt.com. Go to the show notes for this episode and scroll down to the comment section. I'd love to hear from you, your comments, your questions, or whatever. I do my best to interact with my listeners and with my readers there as well. But until next time, remember, your life is a gift. Now go make it count.
This is your